Welcome back to the Autoblog Podcast. I'm Greg Migliori. We have an awesome show for you this week. We're going to talk about some pretty interesting Lexuses we've been driving. That's the LC500H and the Lexus TX, the Texas, we'll call it. Road test editor Zach Palmer has been driving Volvos on ice in Sweden, which is going to be pretty awesome. I can't wait to hear about that. In our news section this week, we'll break down what we expect to see from the next generation of the iconic Toyota 4Runner. We've seen the newest Buick Envision, and it looks pretty good. We'll talk Tesla and F1 as well, and we'll break down our editor's pick from the New York Auto Show. That's editor's picks from the New York Auto Show. And we will spend your money. If you enjoy the show, please give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get the show, and send us your Spend My Monies at podcast@autoblog.com. So with that, road test editor Zach Palmer joins me this week. How are you?
I am doing great. I am glad to be back in, I guess, less snowy Michigan. However, the icy landscape of Sweden, as you were alluding to there, was also pretty sweet.
It sounds awesome.
Man, how about you? How's it going here?
It's chilly and cold, and that's about it. I kind of thought once we hit April, hey, that's usually when you can start to do some of the fun stuff. Not really. April's been as chilly and windy as February, which I think was actually of the last couple months. February was, I think, the nicest month we had. March was, except for a couple days, was fairly nasty. And now April just feels like, I don't know, I would call it winter's finale. I hesitate to call this spring, but so it goes.
I think that's a fair analysis so far. Rain, spring.
Indeed. Indeed. All right, so we're going to start off this week with what we've been driving, our reviews. Some of these are road tests, and some of this is, frankly, your adventure in Sweden. So first of all, why don't you tell me what you drove over there, and let's break it down.
Yeah, man. So I went to the northern reaches of Sweden to drive the Volvo EX30.
Sweet.
Yes, their new, tiny, cute little electric car. The big headline for this one from the start has really been that it's going to start at $36,245, wow. Which, yeah, big deal as far as EVs go. And it's not this little appliance. It's not something that has like 100 miles of range like a Nissan Leaf or a Mini SE. No, this is a car with nearly 300 miles of range. With all-wheel drive, it goes 0 to 60 in 3.4 seconds. Rear-wheel drive, 5.1. All the specs are there. This is a legit, real EV competitor for a really cheap price, which I feel like is something we've been waiting on for a long while now. Every single EV that comes out is, you know, has a starting point in the mid to high 40s, maybe $50,000 range, and at the absolute minimum. But no, that's really what I think drew a lot of us to this car and really what drew me to it at the start. We had a first drive where I know we drove it in Spain and had it on paved roads, but I did something entirely different with it. So Volvo invited us up to Luleå, spelled L-U-L-E-A, but that is the way that you pronounce it up there in Sweden, which is pretty fun to say, actually, going to Luleå. So we started off there. Hopped in some EX30s from the get-go. I hopped in a rear-wheel drive one. And we drove them to a frozen lake, which is a place I think that everybody should eventually try to get to, whether it be in Canada, northern Michigan, Montana, maybe Sweden, maybe somewhere in Scandinavia, if you're over there and can actually get to it easily. This is an automotive experience that I think if you love cars is definitely worth trying out one day. But just to get there was honestly very interesting. So Sweden doesn't really use salt on any of their roads. So that means studded tires, because up there in the north, they have snow-packed roads everywhere you go because it's always snowing. It snowed probably like 90% of the time that I was there. There was one or two clear-ish days where it wasn't constant snow, but for the most part, it's just click clack all over the roads with the studs, and you truly need them to get around. This was also my first time driving on studs. I don't know if you've ever driven on studs, Greg. But it was an interesting experience, to say the least. Not so great and grippy on some of the pavement that I did hit on occasion, but man, on the snow, it felt like I was just like, boom, like locked in, like I was sort of driving on dry pavement with dry weather tires, which was pretty neat. The rear wheel drive Volvo, really, really great. Honestly, it's probably all you need for the road, and you get plenty of range with it too, slightly more than the all wheel drive one. Now, at the same time, if you're like an acceleration fiend, the all-wheel drive one, especially when you put it into the performance all-wheel drive mode, the thing straight up scoots, and it's especially fun on snow because you just get a tail wag from the rear end, and then it just accelerates down the road. But after like an hour and a half drive on the hard-packed snow, trying to catch up and keep up with the local drivers, we did get to the ice track. This is where things got interesting. Really, you kind of have to learn how to drive on ice. It's not like normal track driving. It's not like any normal driving at all. Everything happens slowly. You really have to, you know, force the car into doing what you want to do, in a very graceful and gentle manner. Otherwise things don't go well for you. Hopped out there with the all-wheel drive one first. And so the way that this track was set up, it was about a 75 turn frozen track up there in Gulltrask, Sweden, which is frankly, I mean, to sort of set the scene, like the middle of nowhere. It's a frozen lake, forest all around. There's like no civilization anywhere. There's like five houses that you see within like 30 minutes of even being at the track. So complete dead of winter, middle of nowhere, snow is blinding. But once you get out there, it's like super, super peaceful. So the way that the instructors lined it up, they actually were super helpful in actually getting people to learn how to drive on the ice as soon as you get out there. So it's basically just left, right, left, right. As if you want to go left, basically turn the wheel at the angle that you want to go, hop on the brakes, the rear end comes around, and then as soon as you get the angle that you want, hop back on the gas and start turning the wheel the other way because it's time to go right again. And the way that the all-wheel drive EX30 and the rear-wheel drive EX30 sort of handled it was definitely different. The all-wheel drive one, you can just use the power to just scoot you straight out of every turn. And it was almost a bit of a cheat code to accelerating on those studs, whereas the rear wheel drive one, you had to be much more graceful with. Otherwise, you know, if you got too aggressive with your speed on entry, then you'll end up just sort of floundering on the other side of the corner and not having anywhere near as much luck trying to get momentum going back the other direction. So you had to drive them differently. The handling, honestly, was really, really good from these things, like having the battery super low and just the lightweightness of these cars in general, because they're so small, the EX30 is. It made for a lot of fun out there on the ice lake, honestly. These things are, the all-wheel drive one is just over 4,000 pounds and the rear-wheel drive one is only 3,800 pounds, which in the context of EVs, it's a very light car. Maybe not in the context of other smaller SUVs that are gas powered, but like for what you're getting here, it's actually a pretty agile and fun car to drive out there. So that's sort of driving on the ice in a nutshell. There's a lot more about this car that I can go into. I don't know how in depth we want to go here, but
no, it's cool. It sounds like quite an adventure. I'm glad you got to do it. It was one of those things where when, you know, the trip came up, I thought, well, you know, obviously we don't have to do this, but it seemed very cool. And, you know, those pictures up there really, really sort of paint the picture of what it's like to be on ice, which sounds very trippy to me. I even recognize a few of these journalists here that are in the press photos. When you look at the EX30 itself, I have not driven it yet. It $37,000 is a very competitive price point. And when you consider the average new vehicle price was about $44,000 in March, I think that was looking at different, you know, sources that compile that. That's where I saw it land, which is kind of a crazy figure in itself. But I mean, this seems like a pretty good deal for a respectable EV that sounds like it's pretty fun to drive. I think it looks pretty cool. But what do you think? Where do you think the EX30 is going to sit? Do you think it's, think they have a hit on your hands? Do you think it's too big, too small? Not too big, but too small maybe. You know, tell me about the vehicle itself and your, like,
yeah. You know. So I think that they have a hit for certain use cases. The sort of qualifier there is that the backseat is small, and I mean like small, okay. Small. Maybe European families. I'm not so sure that American families that are used to their Honda CR-Vs, Toyota RAV4s, even full-size pickups to tote their families around are going to want to get into this because even me sitting behind myself, I'm 5'10". I was pretty scrunched back there in the backseat. I have a feeling that a child seat or some kind of booster seat is not going to be very family friendly back there. It's small, and that's sort of reflected in the price. So you just kind of have to know that going in. Where you're really spending your money at is like this awesome powertrain performance, great design, really cool tech. Now, at the same time, that is also another pain point for this car where, so if you like Teslas, if you like super minimalist interiors, you're going to like this. However, that is where a lot of the cost cutting has come in, is eliminating controls, eliminating buttons, and just really simplifying things into a central touchscreen in the same vein as something like a Tesla Model 3 or Model Y. I mean, they've gone so far as to eliminate the rear window switches, sort of like the VW ID4. If you want to put the rear windows down from the front seat, there's a little button to press, which sort of changes the function of the front window switches to the rear. You press the rear button, and then the rears can go down when you press it. You know, there's no speakers in the doors. They use a big sound bar across the front of the car, which helps them eliminate cost complexity from the doors and also gives you more storage. There's no Orpheus crystal shift knob. The little shift column also doubles as a cruise control, which is a little odd to get used to, but I think that you will eventually. There's just so many little things like this. I mean, they take the mirror control away. The volume is a little odd to mess with. It's either on the screen or via the steering wheel buttons. Just everywhere you look, there's like small little things. All right, it's like, all right, we're going to cut costs here, cut costs there. The plastic in it is definitely not as high quality as you'd find in, say, like a Volvo S60 or like a Volvo XC40. Now that said, it's still not like, it doesn't necessarily feel like a $30,000 or something like that economy car. It feels Swedish. It feels luxurious and nice because like they really go all in on colors and themes and lighting and just really neat and interesting recycled materials inside that look cool and are also cheap to produce. There are some caveats here, obviously. It's not a $36,000 price and you're getting a $60,000 car for it. It's definitely not that. But what you do get, all of the important things like the ride quality, the quiet cabin, the awesome powertrain, the great range, really great charging tech, like all that stuff is there. And if you're like an EV enthusiast that like wants that maximum everything at a good price, like you're really, really going to like this car, I think. You just got to know it. Go in knowing that it's not the same Volvo that you've been driving. It's not like a V60 or an XC60. Like you go in there and you might be a little weirded out by a few things here and there. So you go in knowing that, and I honestly think you're really, really going to like the car. I honestly can't wait to get one in the US and try it out on some non-snowpack ice and see how it does. I honestly think that when we do get it in, it's going to split the staff on like who really likes this, who can deal with the minimalism, who likes it, who doesn't like it. It's going to be one of those cards where it's not like universally adored by everybody. I think that I like it a lot. It's not perfect. But I do think that some more time, you know, actually living with it at home is going to really, really shape opinions, yay or nay on it. So we'll see. We'll see when they get in the fleet later this year.
I think, speaking of the value proposition, and I'm going to get into this in a few minutes here. I talk about the Lexus TX 350, which I think is a screaming deal, but I also think both these vehicles, but speaking specifically about the Volvo, really speak to the fact of what do you want to pay for in this current market? Do you want to pay for 275 miles of electric range and then basically nothing else? It looks okay. It sounds like it's kind of fun to drive, but it's a very much a stripper vehicle the way you described it. But for $36,000, that's what you would expect to get, right? And I think it's a little bit of an interesting juxtaposition because a lot of EVs are considered luxury vehicles, or they're at least on the premium sort of spectrum. And companies do that so they can try to make back some of the money they developed, the development cost associated with the batteries and some of the chassis technology and all the different things you need to do to build an EV. So I think it's an interesting time for EVs and what people are willing to pay for them. I also think this vehicle could do extremely well in Europe. I mean, Volvo is a Swedish company. 39.8% of the market is EVs, according to the most recent figures from Bloomberg. And you look at like their neighbor, Norway, is almost 80%. So that's, these are vastly different markets than the United States. But I think it's interesting that they can sort of figure out the charging infrastructure a little bit better over there. And these are big countries with a lot of open space. It's not like there's a lot of different like municipal metropolitan areas where you can set up a bunch of chargers. So I could see this doing very well in Europe. The other thing is when I look at Volvo's lineup, there's a lot of like things going on with it that I think are a little confusing. So you've got the EX30, which is fully electric. You've got the XC40 Recharge, fully electric, which I just drove a few weeks ago. And then the C40 Recharge, which is essentially, this is the really splitting hairs thin here. The XC40 is an SUV. I don't know about that. And the C40 is a crossover. I think the C40 is basically a lifted car. And I'm sorry, I drove the C40. I mean, that tells you how confusing their lineup is when I'm flipping which ones. XC40 is a crossover. And, then you've got the Polestar lineup, which is, part of the same umbrella company, although Geely has been, in the last year or so, been restructuring that. So Polestar is basically really a walled-off kind of situation now. It's not just like a sibling of Volvo or an offshoot of Volvo anymore. So I guess they nominally could compete with each other and it wouldn't be that big of a deal, but it does seem like two pretty similar products going for the same piece of a pie. So all this is to say is it feels like Volvo's lineup is a little confusing right now. And I guess the XC30 probably has the clearest mission because it's the cheapest one. It's pure electric and it's a basic transportation vehicle that is nicer. This isn't like a Honda Fit from 2010, to be clear. Mm-hmm. But all that's just to say it feels like Volvo could do a little bit better of a job of maybe cleaning up what their lineup is and does. And maybe that's normal for this early stage.
Hey, so they're about to change the names on you again here, actually. So for 2024, that is the lineup. But now for 2025, the XC40 Recharge is being renamed the EX40. And the C40 Recharge is being renamed the EC40. So yeah, I guess get ready to learn some more new names, because they are indeed coming. I mean, as far as like electric, I mean, I guess that they're not using like the Recharge name anymore, which kind of was extremely confusing because there are other Recharges within the Volvo lineup that are plug-in hybrids. So it's like, which is it? Is it the plug-in hybrid or is it the EV? Now, I guess they've sort of latched onto something here with the EX30. So now they're just going to start all of their EVs with the letter E. And that's kind of the way I think that they're going to look at it going forward. But yeah, man, it is definitely going to throw people for some loops, just because I feel like the XC40 Recharge has been around for a few years. People know what it's called. And now it's going to be the EX40 and the C40 that, like, we all know what that is. EC40, EX30, EX90, which is eventually coming as well. So I guess the way to try and keep it straight is just if there's an E in front of it, it's an electric Volvo. If there isn't, then it could be a mild hybrid or a plug-in hybrid Volvo. And maybe the Recharge will for sure just be kept to the plug-in hybrids at this point. I think that would probably make it easier, just like give everybody like a couple, two, three, maybe more than that years to learn the new naming structure. And then there might be some more clarity as to what's going on.
All right. So let's shift gears over to something that is much more, let's clear, it's muscular. It's the LC500H. This is the Lexus sports car. I forgot you drove this. So tell me about this. This is kind of cool.
Man, this was genuinely one of the weirder cars I feel like I've driven doing this job. Okay. For a number of years now. I know that both of us have driven like the regular LC500, the one with the 5-liter V8.
Great car.
Yeah, great car. Makes a ton of sense. It's like a luxury personal sport coupe. Like an epic grand tour in all those ways, makes the best sounds, fantastic transmission, good handling. You can get it in both the convertible and the coupe. This was not the 500, but the 500H, which is the hybrid. And frankly, it's one that we haven't had much seat time in ever since it launched. So, but it's always been there ever since like 2017, 2018. The hybrid has been on sale alongside the V8. It's definitely a weird proposition in the large personal luxury coupe space, but leave it to Toyota and Lexus to offer a hybrid in a space where others don't. So powertrain consists of a 3.5 liter V6, a couple electric motors, a 4-speed regular transmission, and an eCVT. So if that all doesn't sound confusing enough, I don't know what does. So needless to say, there's a lot going on. And the way it drives, like if you're privy to like what all is happening there, it makes sense, how it drives. So right away, like, all right, it's a hybrid. So it already sounds a little sad versus the V8. But when you step into the throttle, it actually has a little bit more get up and go right off the line than the V8 does, thanks to those electric motors. That'll do it, right? So I went back and looked at the 0-60 specs after the first time I drove it, and I was like, whoa, a little surprised. It's only 2/10 slower than the V8 to 60. So not a slow car by any means, which was a big plus on its side. And then you start looking and trying to pay attention to that 4-speed automatic in there, and hey, you can actually feel the shifts, which is a little weird for a hybrid that also has a CVT, because you feel those shifts, but then you also notice the pogoing ratios with the eCVT sort of providing step gears in between the four physical gears, and it's just plain weird, man. So you feel those physical shifts, and it's like, oh, there's a shift, there's a shift, but then like in between those shifts are like these little weird CVT blips, like as you get into and off the throttle. And it just makes for like a really, really strange driving experience that is both sporty and not sporty at the same time. it's a really weird one to pin down. Now, if you're really going to drive it hard and try and go have some fun with it, I think that they have a lot of noise augmentation piped into the cabin from the 3.5 V6, which is both a good and bad thing because, A, you want to hear a car like this. This is a fun, like very sporty car. But then at the same time, what you're hearing is the revs just kind of pegging themselves and moving around at high RPM with the occasional bigger shift in there from that 4-speed automatic. So I wouldn't necessarily call it the most sporty thing to drive. I mean, cracking off the shifts from the 5-liter V8 with a 10-speed automatic and the regular LC500 is a million times more fun and interesting to hear than it is this. But at the same time, like you can keep up probably with the 500 on a back road. Say you're out driving with friends. The hybrid is not really losing ground per se to the 500. It's just simply not as fun and engaging to drive. So the handling is all there. You know, it's still rear wheel drive. It still shakes the rear end around like with any provocation. It's honestly even more tail happy than the 500 because those electric motors hit with a ton of torque way down low right away. One thing it is missing though is a limited slip diff. It's one wheel peel everywhere you go, especially. So I was driving it and it was between like, you know, 40 and 55 degrees last week on summer tires. So it was sort of pushing the limits of where you'd want to like switch from summers to all seasons or winters. So the rear was definitely happy to light up at a moment's notice, even without much throttle. Yeah, I guess that's the hybrid portion of the powertrain. There is one other bit here that I think is important to get to, which is this is the 24 LC500, which means it has the interior refresh. So this applies to both the hybrid and the regular 500 too. So I know that the infotainment system has honestly been like the bane of that car's existence since it was introduced. It had the mouse pad, which was like so frustrating to use. Now it has a touchscreen with the latest tech from Volvo, their latest software. And it's definitely a big improvement. Wireless CarPlay, much faster reacting. You no longer have to use a touchpad to operate it. Now that said, like one of my biggest gripes with that thing was trying to get to the heated seats, cooled seats, and heated steering wheel. They still don't have physical buttons for it, even though they did halfway redesign the center console where that was. Instead of like individual buttons, you press one button and it brings up a menu on the screen, which you can then tap through to get to your heated seats and cooled seats and whatnot. So it's still like, if you want to put it on like low or medium, it's still like a three-step process to try and turn on your heated seats. It is less frustrating just because you don't have to use like a little mouse pad and there are fewer misclicks. But it's still not like the most convenient thing in the world, which is a shame because like there are a fair amount of buttons in that cabin. Just none of them are like for some of the things that are most often used, like heated seats. So I wish that I could say it was like a 10 out of 10 improvement, but it's definitely not. It's more like a 6.5 or 7 out of 10 improvement, which was, and that's up from what was like a 2 or a 3 previously. So definitely better, still not perfect. And like I said, that applies to the LC500 too. So then that's definitely the one that I would get after driving both the hybrid and the 500. Definitely go with the V8. Weirdly, the hybrid is actually more expensive than the V8 to start. So that's even more incentive to go with the V8. Yeah, it was at least illuminating to drive the hybrid. It's a little surprising that they still sell it. There must be some people that want the super efficient hybrid. Yeah, give me the V8 every day. And oh, last thing that I will say, this was almost amusing with the hybrid. When I hopped in it, range 710 miles.
Wow.
Okay.
Wow. Yeah, right. So it has a 22.5 gallon tank for the V8 because the V8 gets really poor fuel economy. You hop in the hybrid, it has the same fuel tank. So you can drive for days in that thing with a full tank. It's honestly kind of comical. So I guess if you never want to stop to take a bathroom break on the highway, LC500H is like the car to get, because I don't think I've driven anything else with that big of a range before.
33 miles on the highway. That is very impressive for this car, mm-hmm. this segment. It's, you would have to stretch to find something comparable. So that's cool. I love this car. I would do the V8 all day though. I wouldn't make that perhaps one of the last new sports cars I ever owned, and I would be very happy with it. I think I've thought this thing has been gorgeous for years. The hybrid is a bit of an odd duck. If somebody, like if I won one, I wouldn't say no to it. But I mean, and you know, frankly, if it was like, you know, the end of the world or something for these vehicles, and if my choice is a hybrid or nothing, I'd probably be very happy with it. But V8 all day.
Same. V8 all day.
All right, so let's talk about the Lexus TX350. This is front-wheel drive. I tested it last week, drove around town, put a fair amount of miles on it. It was generally getting about 18 miles per gallon, according to the onboard computer. I generally liked it. I liked it a lot. My big, like the headline for me is, for 55 grand, you're getting an attractive, well-equipped three-row SUV with a legitimate luxury badge on the hood. That is... to me, like it's a great deal. I think it's, again, when you look at the average transaction price is about 44, that it, this is, includes like everything. So for about 55, you're saying, hey, this is a Lexus. It's a big one. You could put people and stuff in it. You know, this isn't like a Challenger brand or some brand that's trying to offer a bunch of incentives. This is a freaking Lexus, man. And it's, you know, it's huge. So, I mean, I think that also speaks to is, like Americans, we value size in our vehicles. So you look at the EX30, the Volvo, and it's like, oh, geez, $36,000. We don't necessarily prize that range. I mean, some people do, but I think as a society, we don't. But we do prize enormous troop transporter SUVs. And for 55 grand, that's a good deal. So now then there's some downsides to it. I think it's, you get a nice ride. But this isn't like, say, a BMW X5 with that, you know, really sweet turbo inline six, or even the six of the Mazda CX-90, which is in our long-term fleet. Or no, wait, I'm sorry, we have the plug-in hybrid, but it's in other CX-90s, let's put it that way. So you're not getting like what I would say a truly premium powertrain. You're getting a turbo four-cylinder, and this is front-wheel drive. So, okay, if you want to get... you know, you want to get, you know, all-wheel drive, boom, plunk down another $1,600. The interior has new luxe interior trim. Have you seen that in some of the Lexuses you've driven?
I have seen the new luxe leather. Yeah, is that their sort of like synthetic leather that they've...
Synthetic, yeah. 65% fewer CO2 emissions to manufacture. They say it's easier to clean. But I can tell you, it does not feel very much like leather. Probably not like what you were rolling around in the LC500 or LC, which I believe has an amazing interior the last time I was in one. The tan leather in that, I still remember this. Like you could eat it with a fork. It looked so good. This reminded me more of like, I don't know, just like a mid-level sort of leathery thing, which I guess is what it is. So, hey, like I said, there's some trade-offs here. You know, 275 horsepower, it's adequate, but I mean, I wouldn't say it's quick by any sense. It's torquey. You get 317 pound-feet, as low as 1700 RPM. So that's where you get a little bit of juice off the line. You know, inside you get a 14-inch touchscreen and there's a 12-speaker sound system. So like all of the, like the tech stuff is there. Heated seats, which is not bad considering most luxury brands, like say BMW, they would make you pay for that. Now you didn't get a heated steering wheel and, you know, it, again, it didn't feel amazingly luxurious inside there. But again, it certainly looked the part. 20-inch wheels. It's got that big Lexus spindle grill. It's called Windchill Pearl is the color. So when you pull up, it looks like this, you know, really sleek, expensive-looking polar bear of an SUV. Definitely looks the part. Like, you could pull up to your golf club and park next to an X5 or an X7 or a Cayenne and not feel inadequate at all. Granted, you probably paid maybe a third less than your fellow parking lot mates. So, I mean, just to kind of bring it all together, I like it. I think it's a good value. I think you get most of the stuff you want. I think you do make some compromises. And frankly, though, if you want to make a really good deal, go get a Grand Highlander, which genetically is the same thing. But a lot of people buy Lexus vehicles, and a lot of them are Toyotas. And I see no reason to really punish this one for that. So I liked it a lot. Put a lot of stuff in it. Family liked it. Comfortable. It felt like a luxury vehicle for a very good price, is how I would sum it up.
Yeah, it sounds like, you know, some of the things that might be holding it back is definitely that powertrain.
Yeah.
And that, like, you can get other powertrains with the TX, like the hybrid and also the plug-in hybrid. Although I am looking at the price breakdown of it here. And wow, like, if you want the hybrid, like, the cheapest entry point into it is almost $71,000, which is nowhere close to the one that you were testing. I know you were mentioning it was in the 50s. So yeah, man, it sounds like things can get better, but you kind of have to pay through the roof to get it. So I guess you just kind of got to prioritize which do you want? Do you want that sweet hybrid powertrain, or just want that bigness, like you were saying? Like, yeah, it's a tough call. I don't know if you've tried them both, but, it would be a tough call to step up like another 15 to 20 grand to get the hybrid, I feel.
I think in some ways there may be two different Lexus customers at this point too. You know, somebody who gets the hybrid is probably more interested in that tech and also, you know, probably more affluent. And then you get somebody who's like, well, 55 out the door, I can swing that, you know, maybe get a decent car rate. And that's more on the upper reaches, and they know that. And they're still driving a Lexus, which gives you probably, I would say, 80% of the, like, the prestige, the aura you're looking for, because, you know, dude walking by your car doesn't realize that you have the very basic powertrain. So, yeah. So, all right, that's the Lexus TX. Let's run through some news. We got a few touchstones here. We'll try to get through them kind of quickly. I guess we'll stay with the Toyota world. The 4Runner, we've seen some teaser shots of it. It is, you know, it's out there. Check them out on our site. By the time you hear this podcast, we may have more previews, more, just more news about it. We think it could be revealed next week, and that's about all we can say. Generally speaking, I'm very excited to see what they're going to do with this, what kind of powertrain improvements they're going to throw at it. Ultimately it'll come down for me how it drives too. Because when I think of the 4Runner, it's just this old, bouncy, jouncy, old school SUV that every time I drive one, it feels like I'm still driving the same one as when I first started out in this car business, which I love. So I will be intrigued to see how they maintain those ethos, but they got to do something modern here. So, and they've got a lot to work with in their toolkit now with the, you know, the Land Cruiser out there. The Lexus GX, you know, there's certainly bones and things they could borrow and throw at this to make a new 4Runner. So, I mean, what are you thinking, expecting for the new 4Runner?
Man, I'm certainly excited that it's finally happening and finally gonna, like, be revealed, because I know that it has been around for, looks like 15 years at this point. And by the time it eventually does come around, it'll probably be 16. So that's cool. We're finally getting a new one. I'm hoping that it does not have a 5-speed automatic transmission. I jest, because it definitely will not. No, the 4Runner is like the last new car on sale today that has only a 5-speed automatic. It's honestly kind of funny at this point. It's just a running joke. But hey, people love them. Like, 4Runner sales are not slowing down at all. because it's just like this big old dinosaur that never changes and people love it the way it is. So I think that Toyota really needs to like step into that and like really embrace the fact that people love the 4Runner the way it is and not try and screw up a good thing. From all the rumors and everything that I've seen so far, I think that is where they're going with it. It looks like it's going to be heavily related to the new Tacoma and the Land Cruiser, which would probably mean it has a four-cylinder turbocharged engine, maybe one or two outputs. I'm not so sure. I mean, the current 4Runner only has one powertrain option, so they could just kind of keep that the way it is and not change anything. It's certainly going to slot in under the Land Cruiser, which is a hybrid-only powertrain. So I know that the Land Cruiser is starting right around 56, 57. So we can hopefully see the 4Runner, you know, maybe start in the low 40s. Should give it, I feel like, a pretty good gap to the Land Cruiser. Just from that single photo that we've seen, they're clearly going to offer it in a sweet blue. I like the new 4Runner logo. Looks like nice and chunky off-road look, but it's not too in your face like a Raptor or TRX logo. It definitely looks like it's adopting sort of the latest Toyota blocky off-road design that we see in their trucks. So I'm definitely pretty optimistic about what Toyota's done here. I think, you know, just based on what they've done with the Tacoma and the Land Cruiser, that they understand their off-road enthusiasts like to a T, and I fully expect the 4Runner to continue along that path. And maybe people will be slightly mad that it's no longer a naturally aspirated V6 with a 5-speed automatic that has literally been around forever, but they got to make it modern. And that means giving it, you know, hopefully better fuel economy, better efficiency everywhere, and a lot more tech. So I'm excited to see it. And it's looking very promising so far.
Yeah. And I, like you, I'm okay with an updated powertrain. I don't look at the current powertrain as something special, like it's the Jeep 4-liter or something. Nah. You know, it's just what they pulled off the shelf, 15 years ago or whatever they, you know, develop this. And, you know, I personally wouldn't mind if they maintain that bouncy, jouncy ride dynamic, which feels old school, and, you know, is akin to many off-road like vehicles. But I think there's definitely some room for improvement there. I'm excited. We'll see. Somebody at my son's school had a forest green 4Runner, about 20 years old. And I don't know, immaculately maintained. They just kind of pulled through the drop-off loop. And that really got me thinking about 4Runners and kind of excited about 4Runners too. You know, I think with all the talk about the FJ Cruiser or Compact Cruiser coming around, the Land Cruiser, the Lexus GX, it's been easy to kind of forget just how, you know, how deep the 4Runner really hits with a lot of people. And I think too, it would be an amazing used car to pick up and just drive around town, drive it, get it dirty. You know, the current generation, that is, drive it for the next 20 years. That reliability, you know, who knows, it might outlive you. So, all right, let's shift gears over to the Buick Envision. You wrote this story. It's new for 2024. It gets some of those good looking like concept vibes we've seen, kind of like the Avista. Buick design, I would put it in the same bucket as, say, Kia right now, which is brands that, at least recently, haven't really been known for their design, but in the last few years have just been crushing it. And frankly, it's, I think, brands that you might not expect to be amazingly, you know, good at design, and they are. It's like they've made it a calling card, and I think all of their products look very, very good. I have an EV9 in my driveway, a little more polarizing, but I like it. This Buick looks great, and I think Buick's getting some of its design mojo back that we haven't seen since, I don't know, the 70s, the 60s. So tell me about this Envision.
Yeah, man, that attractive design, it all sort of starts from that Wildcat EV concept that they unveiled a couple of years ago, and they basically just like used that face and are putting it on all of their SUVs, which, not a bad thing, because that Wildcat EV concept was extremely good looking. I will, like, every time I mention that thing, though, I will just say, like, hey, Buick, please make it, because, like, a two-door performance EV coupe would really revive the brand if you wanted to make Buick cool again, at least, as opposed to slapping it on a bunch of SUVs. But I digress. The Envision, you know, this is sort of like a mid-cycle refresh for it. You know, I honestly thought it was a really, really great, like, total redesign a few years ago. And this kind of brings it up to date with the rest of its lineup and really kind of pushes the interior design forward, though. I really think that the highlight here is the fact that it has this new 30-inch, like, widescreen display that sort of wraps from the instrument cluster to almost to the passenger side of the dash. It's very similar to what you see, you might see on, like, a Cadillac Lyric. It's not curved in the same way. It's not quite as fancy. But it is a similar size, and it does look like a similar software setup just from looking at the infotainment system itself. So that is really gonna, like, ramp up the feeling of premium and luxury in that cabin, because it's a really good screen. It's super responsive. It has really great color use, and just is all around, like, a big, big improvement, I think, for the Envision that previously had, like, a pretty analog looking setup. And they also did go to a column shifter, as opposed to the weird sort of push button thing that they had before. I think that's an improvement, sort of frees up the center console a bit. And, the last big bit, though, is that we're bringing, like, sweet colors to the interior. So, like, in the press photos for this one, we're looking at sort of like a deep red and black two-tone combo. But there's also going to be, like, a blue and gray option too. Which, as you mentioned, Kia there, Kia has gone really deep into colors for the interior, and it's good to see Buick getting a little more exciting than something like a black, gray, beige. Let's get some real color in there and sort of push down market. Maybe try and find some young people that are excited about, you know, red seats with white contrast stitching and a huge screen across the dash. Big improvement for them. The one disappointment, though, is the lack of Super Cruise, which is definitely a miss from GM and Buick. So this was sort of like the second reveal for this car. Like, so almost a year ago, they showed, like, one single image of it. And they're like, here's the new front face. Also, it's going to have Super Cruise. And now when they came out with this new press release here, Super Cruise was mysteriously missing. And so I shot an email over to Buick, and they're like, well, actually, it didn't work. We're not getting Super Cruise onto a Buick with the Envision here. They said that their timeline shifted, and they're not really sure when exactly Super Cruise is going to be launching on Buick models, but just that it'll be happening sometime in the future. That is honestly one thing that could have put this thing over the top for a lot of reasons. Because, like, when you look at, like, the premium, like, compact SUV space, how many of them have technology where you can take your hands off the wheel on the highway? I think that really would have been, like, a standout feature for this car that a lot of people would have gone for. And just the fact that it's missing is definitely sad. Especially when they said that it was, in fact, going to be on the feature set before. So, miss there. Hopefully it gets introduced in the next year or so. If it does, I think that really, really makes the Envision a much, much more attractive buy, too.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it could have been a very key differentiation point for Buick, especially in this segment. You know, it would have been a very substantive technological upgrade that, you know, gave this, you know, this Buick some heft behind it. It's not just a pretty face. It's a really, you know, competitive, you know, small crossover. So I will say this, General Motors has been cautious about rolling out Super Cruise, wanting to make sure they get it right, that it works with purpose in each and every vehicle they put it in. So, I mean, we'll see. Another company that was a little more aggressive about rolling out autonomous driving is Tesla, and with perhaps the opposite approach. And let's a good segue to talk about them right now. And they had a kind of a rough first quarter. They just announced some deliveries, which were well below expectations. They had about 387,000 deliveries. It's about 13% below what some analysts, I'm looking at Morgan Stanley, they're generally among the most thorough analytical firms that dives deep into Tesla. Yeah, that was about 9 or 10% below estimates. So I've seen some industry watchers call this really like, oh, the sky is falling. I don't particularly believe that, but I do think it was an uncharacteristically rough quarter for Tesla in a way that you don't normally see. Now, you can chalk that up to a lot of randomness. First of all, you've got logistical challenges trying to get their things across the Red Sea. Because there's all sorts of, upheaval in that part of the world. They had arson at their Gigafactory in Germany, and the Model Y changeovers, they roll out the updated version of the car, I think, hit production a little bit. But also, EV sales were kind of flat. You know, it's like there's two stories when it comes to EV sales right now. They were up, I saw a figure, 60% last year, but also for the first quarter of this year, market share has dropped from about 8% to about 7% for EVs. So that tells me that people are still buying them, people are still excited to buy them, but we're still kind of in this plateau where the numbers are, basically what the numbers are saying is people are very kind of lukewarm on them. You know, you're going to have some months where they look amazing, there's going to have some months where they look bad, and it, right now, I think that just kind of reflects the broader trend of people are a little unsure about them. And also, I think Tesla is kind of a unique case in and of itself. You know, I think there's a number of people who are like, they don't separate the product from Elon Musk, and they're either not buying a Tesla or they're buying a different EV, or they're just maybe not buying an EV or a car. And I think that's all manifesting itself in Tesla's pretty poor performance in the first quarter. Tesla being Tesla, they usually turn it around and have another great quarter. They've been a company that's always outperformed from a stock perspective and a delivery perspective. So I tend to think they'll probably mount a comeback. But I mean, just generally thinking, what's your state of Tesla?
Yeah, I'm sort of along the same lines as you. Like, all right, yeah, it does look like a bad quarter. At the same time, like, I expect it to not be like two bad quarters in a row, three bad quarters in a row. I mean, the refresh of the Model 3 is honestly probably going to be like a huge boost to them this year, I would suspect, because that car has been on the market for a long while now. And just the fact that people now have the opportunity to go buy, you know, something new, and, you know, it's not dramatically different. But it is a very new and updated EV that both enthusiasts and I think just regular Tesla fans can, you know, they have an excuse to go trade in that 2019 or 2020 Model 3 now because there's a new model. Now, that said, is it going to be as impactful as like a Model Y refresh? No, I don't think so. They could definitely use one of those in the U.S. here, since that is such a popular car. Just anecdotally, you see them everywhere these days, just because crossovers and SUVs are so popular. So refresh Model 3, great. That'll be a bit of a boost. A refresh Model Y, if they can somehow launch that this year, I think that that would give them an even larger boost to where they're at, and definitely get their overall quarter sales to a healthier place than where they're at now.
All right. So on the drama list, Tesla, and then F1 is actually another home to a lot of drama in the car world these days. We have the Grand Prix in Japan this weekend, which follow along Autoblog all weekend. We'll have updates from qualifying, from practice, of course, the race. I mean, I don't know, Max is probably going to win again. You know, there's no reason to doubt that right now. But we're about a month into the season. How are you feeling about F1? Is perhaps you and Jeremy are our most ardent F1 fans. How are you feeling so far? Maybe an eighth of the way into the season.
Well, it definitely makes the races more exciting when Max has a DNF from a mechanical failure.
Yeah.
So, hey, maybe Max won't win this race again. Maybe his brake will get stuck, although I'm sure the Red Bull has that figured out from Australia from a couple weeks ago. So, assuming that everything is okay with Max's car, he is clearly like far and away faster than everybody else, including his teammate Sergio Perez, who really hasn't been able to make much of an impact on him this year in a similar vein as last year. Frankly, honestly, it seems like Max is even more dominant than he was last year, as Sergio has, well, not won anything yet, versus Sergio was actually coming out of the gates pretty strong at the start of 2023. The one exciting storyline, I think, that we've seen so far, like sort of curtailing from last year and into this year, is just Carlos Sainz and like his just success. Like, he was literally the only guy other than a Red Bull driver to win a race last year. And now he is the only guy who isn't a Red Bull driver to win a race this year too. And it's especially entertaining because he's the driver that Ferrari is getting rid of next year and replacing him with Lewis Hamilton. So yeah, maybe Charles Leclerc needs to step up to do something here, to, you know, like, hey, I am the number one driver for a reason here. There's a reason that Ferrari is having me stick around, because right now Carlos has arguably had more success in the, winning department than Charles has. So there's that angle. And then I honestly, one other thing, that has just been a little bit of a disappointment for me has been the Racing Bulls, the Red Bull Junior team almost. I know that they had a lot of hype surrounding them at the start of the year. Everybody was thinking, oh, they're going to be in the top 10 fighting for points. And they just really haven't at all. And, you know, this is also Yuki Tsunoda's home race coming up here in Japan. I think it would be really cool just to see them, you know, get up there, find some updates, do something, here at the start of the year. Especially for Yuki's home race, which I know that everybody going to Suzuka will be really glad to see him do something well. So yeah, I guess in a nutshell, that's sort of what I'm seeing so far and going to be watching for. Maybe Ferrari can make something happen again this week. Who knows?
We'll see. I would like to see a little more life out of Ferrari. I mean, just when they're good, I think it's good for the sport. I think any sort of, you know, more competitive life we can see, I think, would be a good thing this week. And I, you know, it's always an interesting circuit. It's definitely, you know, a lot of history. So yeah, looking forward to it. It's going to be a good race. All right. So let's run through our Ed's picks. We have them from New York. We hinted at them last week, on the podcast, but now we have them. We did all the voting, which has been tabulated. And, you know, I think my voting generally went along with what, you know, most people were, you know, looking for. But the Kia K4 hatch was our winner, was our best in show. I think people really were excited by the, you know, just the styling. It was a surprise. I think it was, you know, something that people really, it was sort of a surprise and delight, you know. So I'll run through the full list here and you tell me what you think. Number five was the Nissan Kicks. Number four was the QX80. I actually voted for that number two. I just thought it had a lot of presence. Number three was the K4 sedan itself, proper. Number two was the GV60 Magma, which kicks off sort of a performance-like line of vehicles for Genesis. And then in first place was the K4 hatchback. As car journalists, we love hatchbacks. How did you vote? How do you feel about this?
Yeah, you know, I generally agree with things. That said, I did put the GV60 Magma in first place.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah, man, I just love the heck out of this thing. the orange paint, just, and also just the fact that Genesis is, you know, actually exploring a true performance lineup, you know, in the same vein as something like an AMG or BMW M. It's exciting. I mean, you look at some of the other performance EVs that the Hyundai Group has put out with the Ioniq 5N, which, man, I am extremely excited to drive that car. It looks like the real deal. So if we can get like luxurious performance cars from Genesis, whether they be the GV60 or, you know, something like a GV70 in the SUV and gasoline powered realm, man, that would be so, so sweet. And just from the preview here with the GV60 Magma, great name, great design, great changes, I think, for it. So really, really looking forward to that. And I certainly do not frown upon the K4 being the first place choice, because I made that my second place vote, very close to first. It is just so, so good looking. And we didn't get any pictures of the interior, but the photos of the interior for just the regular K4 tell me that it is going to be very, very nice and possibly offer some cool colors on the inside too. So it's just really sweet that, like, you know, there wasn't a hatch in this space before from Kia, and now there is, which is honestly the opposite of the way things go most of the time around here. Like, wagons and hatches disappear, sedans and SUVs, you know, it's mostly just SUVs do appear. So it's neat that Kia is sort of taking the chance and throwing a hatchback out there with this new generation that's replacing the Forte. And yeah, hopefully they give it to us in the GT line turbo as well. Get like a 1.6 liter turbo, pair that with an 8-speed dual clutch automatic. Great little, you know, semi-hot hatch, maybe like a warm hatch at that point. So
sounds like an editor's pick for when we actually review the vehicle.
Sure.
Definitely has all of the all of the key elements we would like. So yeah, it was a good show. Hyundai Motor Co. put out a great performance with all three of its brands. I mean, I thought it was especially impressive that Kia get two of the top three. So, I mean, you know, it was a good show. Let's spend some money. Dan in Alberta writes, "Hey guys, I'm in the market for a new-to-me car in the next year. I'm turning 40 and will have saved $50,000, which I assume is Canadian, which is $37,000 US. How should I spend it to have the most fun? I've typically gravitated to the muscle car group and considered a Camaro 2SS, Mustang GT, and Challenger RT. I would love a manual for the modern anti-theft device." Hey, that's true. "I have an F-150 and an Escape as our family's regular rides. Don't know if I can, but I'd like something faster. Have some bragging rights for my brother's 2019 M5. Might be a pipe dream. It's pretty fast." It is a fast car. "I've considered a ZL1 or modifying an SS Camaro as well. Located in Alberta. Wonder if he is a Flames or an Oilers fan." We'll see. So, there is a lot you can play with in this segment. I will pick Pony Car, but before I reveal my answer, I will kick it over to you.
Yeah, you know, just like you said, there's a lot going on in this segment. If you really, like, well and truly do want to beat your brother's M5, probably one of the best ways to do that is to go pick up a Mustang GT and throw a supercharger on it, maybe a Pro Charger. You can probably, you know, get one that's nicely spec'd, nicely optioned. It's probably going to be one like an earlier previous generation. So the S550, the one with the independent rear suspension, I would definitely suggest that because it's both, you know, muscle car and sports car at that point. But get one with the 5-liter V8. If you can swing one with, like either one or two performance packages on it, the PP1 and PP2, I would definitely gravitate towards those. And then, you know, go to who knows where, either Ford Performance, Pro Charger, Roush, sort of just pick your poison and slap a supercharger on that thing. And you're going to be making 700, 800 horsepower without too much effort. And, you know, from everything I've seen, those cars are fairly reliable when you try to push a lot of power with the supercharger. You know, that might, you know, with mods, that'll probably take you over your 50,000 Canadian budget. So maybe do it over the course of time, you know, buy the car now, maybe save up for a year, buy the supercharger, save up for another year, get the intake and exhaust. Just do, and actually, before you do the supercharger, do some really good tires on the car, because you're going to need it if you really want to push that much power, and actually be able to hook it. So you do that, you'll be faster than your brother's M5, and honestly, probably be able to keep up with him on a back road or even a track too, because the Mustang is quite the do-it-all sports car, muscle car in one. So that's where I'd go.
That is a very strong recipe right there for taking a basic Mustang and making it an M5 beater. I think that's a smart way to do it. I also would recommend a Mustang because when you look at, it's just part of his emotional preference. I would pick a Mustang over that era of Camaro and Challenger, both of which are absolutely fun to drive. And as you can see, you can either buy them like, you know, a used one with plenty of horsepower or do some mods. But I do think the stronger pony car of the last probably, you know, 8, 9, 10 years would be the Mustang. So I would go with that. I would throw some mods at it, like you suggest, Zach. You laid that out very eloquently. Also look at things like the clutch, the suspension, if you want to truly go head to head with a Bimmer, especially an M5. But, you know, I think that would be the car that you will enjoy daily driving the most, but also you'll be able to get plenty of performance out of it. I think Challenger is actually probably my second suggested daily driver, just because it can be quite comfortable. Camaro is a great pony car, but, you know, they're tough to see out of. You know, even in some of the lesser powered trims, they still can be kind of harsh, despite the fact that I think they have the best pure chassis in the group. I think you get some of that Cadillac engineering in there. I forget what version of platform underpins it. It's not Zeta, Delta.
It might be
Alpha. There we go. My third Greek one. It's probably the best pure platform. But assuming you're going to do more than just race your brother and track it, there's other considerations. So that would, again, make me land on the Mustang. So great question. Thanks for writing, Dan. You've got me thinking of random Calgary Flames, the Edmonton Oilers now, from back in the day. So, I think we can leave it there. Thanks for writing, Dan. And thank all of you for listening. Thank you, Zach, for hanging out. It is podcast@autoblog.com. If you want to get into the mailbag or send us another Spend My Money, be safe out there. We'll see you next week.